Hey everyone, welcome back to the 443 Security Simplified. I'm your host, Mark the Liberty, and joining me today is...
Ghostly Cory Knockreiner! Happy belated Halloween!
Spooky Cory Knockreiner. On today's episode, we cover an alert from US CISA about an imminent threat to the healthcare system of the United States, an update on, and a couple updates on election hacking related topics, including quite a bit of money stolen from one political party in one state, and a basically script kiddie going in for the lulz. With that, let's go ahead and trick-or-treat
on
it.
What did you do now, Mark?
Nothing.
I told you, it's not funny anymore.
I plead the fifth. So just last week, the U.S. CISA, the Center for Information Security Alerts, did I get that right? There are so many dang acronyms in this world. Anyways.
Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. related to U.S. CERT.
Yep. In partnership with the FBI and the Department of Health and Human Services, released an advisory that was warning of an imminent and credible threat to U.S. hospitals and healthcare providers. Throughout the day after this alert, six different hospitals noted they had been targeted by this threat we are about to discuss, and they noted there were potentially hundreds more that attackers had targeted but not successfully exploited yet. So in the alert, they highlighted multiple indicators of compromise from the TrickBot malware that we've talked about, what was it, just 2 weeks ago now? As well as detailing the tactics of how they deploy the Ryuk ransomware. So TrickBot, if you listened to our podcast 2 weeks ago, Microsoft has been having a pretty big push trying to disrupt their infrastructure, at one point disabling something like 94% of all of their command and control servers. Obviously, it is not 100% gone, though, considering this pretty hardcore, I guess would be the word to put out, or at least topical alert from US CERT. A few takeaways from it. The alert's actually pretty detailed on all the tools, tactics, and procedures that the threat actors for TrickBot have been using. They even use the MITRE ATT&CK framework throughout it, as we've been seeing a lot of alerts used these days.
Yeah, by the way, I just wanted to do a shout out to secplicity.org. Speaking of that MITRE ATT&CK framework, since we now also own Panda Security, an endpoint security company. If you go to secplicity.org and read some of the last posts, we actually have some pretty detailed analysis from real-world interesting malware campaigns. And I just wanted to do a shout-out to you, Mark, and our team, who, if you read those alerts, you'll notice we're using some of the MITRE ATT&CK framework in our alerts as well.
Yep. You can even find those under the research tag for articles, which is where I believe we're posting them. Throughout the U.S. CERT alert, though, they noted a few details of the botnet. First off, they noted that it's using the Anchor DNS toolkit to tunnel command and control traffic over DNS. And hiding command and control traffic, both to the server and commands from the server, does tend to be a bit of a big selling point for some botnets. Like, obviously, if you are just sending HTTP GET or POST requests, it makes it a lot easier for even any firewalling service to inspect and identify that potential connection. But DNS adds another layer of obfuscation to your communication to that server. The traffic is quote-unquote encrypted, but it just uses a single byte XOR, meaning every single byte of traffic is binary XOR'd with a single byte key. So it's not hardcore encryption, it's more like obfuscation at that point. Basically, I'd equivocate it with, base64 encoding it. But it does make it at least a little more difficult for some network services to automatically spot and point it out. They also noted that the threat actors are using living off the land techniques. So they're using native tools like PowerShell and Windows Management Instructions, WMI, and RDP to move laterally throughout the network, which is pretty much in line with everything we've seen from TrickBot recently. They seem to be using a lot of tools like PowerSploit, Cobalt Strike, PowerShell Empire, and in some cases even Mimikatz to steal these passwords and password hashes out of memory, and then use those to infect other systems. And I think we've talked a lot about this on the podcast, where threat actors these days, especially in ransomware attacks, it's no longer, you know, whoever downloaded the ransomware payload, whether it be someone in accounting or your secretary or even an IT administrator, it's not their computer.
Who knows? Maybe your CTO.
Who knows? Maybe your CTO. It's not just them that gets hit with that ransomware. Like, they download it, they run it, they're encrypted, they're done. Instead, many of these attacks, they start by not with the ransomware payload itself, but with a botnet like TrickBot. And then they use that infection to then scope out the rest of the network so that they can launch a more devastating attack a little bit later once they've identified any computer or server they can get into, potentially identified your backups or security services, which makes them a lot more damaging in the end.
It's all about lateral movement, whether it's manual or automated. Like, once you have a backdoor on a machine, most attackers want to see how they can leverage that machine to laterally move.
Yep. And in the case of TrickBot, they're using living off the land attacks and these tools like Cobalt Strike and PowerShell or PowerSploit to move laterally and perform the reconnaissance and steal credentials without having to drop malware binaries on the computer. It's all fileless at this
point. By the way, I don't know if you mentioned this, but if folks out there haven't heard of Cobalt Strike, you've probably heard me and Mark talking about Metasploit a lot as an exploit framework. Cobalt Strike is actually very similar to Metasploit. It's a totally similar exploit framework. It's been productized. Do you know Cobalt Strike? You know, their focus is just like Metasploit, to mostly be a good guy pen tester tool. You know, they made the product and they even sell Cobalt Strike licenses for auditing and pen testing. So it's supposedly a tool used for good, but obviously just like Metasploit, despite being made for a pen test tool by the good guys, these tools are used heavily by the bad guys as well too.
Largely because, like you said, they are really good tools. They're quite powerful, especially...
They're easy.
Yeah, especially...
It's an easy button for hacking.
Exactly.
I don't have to look at memory offsets or figure out how to exploit a heap overflow if it's all built into some tool in an importable script for me.
Exactly.
Staging, writing assembly language tiny stagers is a huge pain in the butt that very few people can do. Why not use these lovely pre-built stagers?
Sounds like you're getting a little bitter there, Corey. Do you have something in your history you want to talk about?
No. I'm just saying it takes all... Things like Metasploit and Cobalt Strike have lowered the bar to hacking, right? I mean, hacking used to be something that's a very difficult thing. Even if you found a good exploitable vulnerability, you had to write your own script, do your own assembly researching to figure out where you needed to put code in memory. Then you had to figure out how much space you had and write very succinct, tiny machine language code. And that was the hard part of hacking. That's what really made it something that only a select few people could do. Cobalt Strike and Metasploit, which we do love because they also give us the ability to test our stuff easily, but they do lower the bar. You simply don't need to know much. It's similar to pineapples.
Back in my day.
Huh?
Back in my day, we didn't have any of these dang pineapples.
We only had a command line. But yeah, I mean, pineapples are the same thing. I don't hate these tools. I'm just saying at all. In fact, I use them. I want the same easy button everyone else does, because I definitely couldn't find my way out of heap today, especially with all the memory protection mechanisms. My point just is these fantastic tools that we should use in the security community, you know, do know they're used maliciously too. And pineapples, just for so you know, I diverted to Wi-Fi hacking, but it's the same thing. Everything a pineapple did the first day it was released, anyone could have done with Aircrack and other tools on a Linux machine if they knew how to open the multiple command lines and run the commands. Pineapple is just a convenient form factor for the hardware tied to a wonderful GUI to make even a monkey be able to do it. So, fantastic tools, but the downside to making it so easy is now the cyber criminal does not have to be technically sophisticated.
Yeah, and you're right, it's really lowered the bar for cyber attacks. And like, there's other things that have lowered the bar as well, even to make like these attacks evasive. Like, there's tools all over the place now that can take any malware payload whatsoever and get it past like signature based anti-malware. Like, Packers encryptors are free or like $10 on an underground forum, and they work really well.
Yeah,
too.
I think maybe we should do a episode in the next few months just talking about the malware ecosystem or malware as a service, because I think what we're really getting to is, you know, we've lost the protection of writing exploits being hard, in that it really has been commercialized by the bad guys. So anyways, back to the CISA alert story. I heard that one of our favorite bloggers was also talking about this particular attack.
Yeah, so security journalist Brian Cripp, great segue, by the way, Corey. Not ham-fisted in there at all. Security journalist Brian Krebs was actually one of the first people to scoop this story, basically. In his discussion, though, he noted that there was a conference call from government officials to healthcare leadership before this alert went public. But during that call, they didn't actually provide any indicators of compromise. They just told them, basically, patch your systems and be on the lookout for suspicious activity, which kind of like what my conclusion I draw from that is the attacks probably originated, at least in part, with exploiting unpatched vulnerabilities and systems. If they're telling people just to keep them up to date. That said, like, we've seen TrickBot delivered through phishing quite frequently, even in our own threat intelligence from blocked attacks. So there's a whole bunch of different ways it can get in.
Definitely could be that they knew of a particular vulnerability. It could also be that they still didn't, you know, they were still researching, so didn't have the IOCs, so were just giving general security advice. Like, if I knew there was some sort of threat out there, I would say, you know, put up your firewalls, have antivirus and patch too. So could be either way, but you're right. Maybe there is some specific vulnerability, which we'll talk about later, that might have been used.
Yeah.
By the way, at this point, I assume anyone listening to us knows what an IOC is, but essentially, if you don't, indicator of compromise, and it's something like known bad hashes for bad files, known domains, IPs, or URLs associated with a particular campaign. It's just things you can plug into your security products, your security controls, network, and endpoint to either block these malware files or block the command and control channels or other resources that the malware uses.
Yep. Now, I mentioned Brian Krebs. He is a journalist, and you and I, like, we both like Brian Krebs. He posts a lot of really, like, he has obviously contacts or at least a presence on underground and dark web forums, so he's able to get a lot of really detailed information on threat actors out there.
Yeah. And a lot of his scoops are legitimate scoops. So a lot of the time, the whole industry learns it from Brian Krebs first.
Because of largely his research.
His contacts.
Yeah. But
oh, and his research. Like, he started as a journalist, but I think, and even though he partners with security researchers too, I believe he has kind of become at least someone smart enough that he can do a lot of security research as far as finding malware actors and really understanding the technical details of threats.
Yeah.
So he's a kind of a researcher in his own regard, in a way.
One thing I did notice, though, is after he scooped the story before CISA actually released their alert, he was called out on Twitter by a lot of security researchers, basically saying that this was not TLP White is the acronym they used. So TLP is CISA's Traffic Light Protocol, which is basically red, yellow, green, or white, which indicates whether you can share information or who you can share information with, or if it's freely available to share information. And they pointed out that this was not freely shareable information yet, and he was potentially tipping off threat actors that the FBI was onto them, which might have caused them to speed up their attacks on people that were unprepared. And I thought, like, you know, so Krebs is a journalist. I have the right to publishing journalistic articles, but you do have to consider, like, in the case of this, where if it's a bunch of hospitals and the government's trying to help them get their defenses up, like the FBI and CISA with these alerts at the conference calls, and someone goes and tips off the threat actors that defenses are about to go up, is there some responsibility on his part to maybe withhold getting the scoop for the sake of defenses of these hospitals? It was a bit of like a moral quandary.
I don't know, but this is definitely. I honestly, for this one, I don't care too much. I don't really think anything of him letting them know hospitals are aware could change the attacker's strategy in a way that helps them one way or the other personally. But to your point, I mean, it's like, let's say with the Snowden releases, you know, journalists have a responsibility to publish things from sources that affect citizens all around the world. On the flip side, most responsible journalist organizations look at the data they're getting and redact things or don't say things if they put others in danger. So I think that this is a typical thing a journalistic organization would go through. And that's why they limited timing in publication. You know, Snowden gave some media outlets full, here's all the stuff. I expect you as the media organization to vet how you release this and do it responsibly. And I think a lot of journalist organizations probably did. You know, they're not, if there's a list of names of CIA operatives in every single country, you know, even if you're trying to disclose some bad stuff, you probably will hide those names as a journalist organization. So I don't have an opinion too much on this one. I understand the gist of the argument. And technically, if it is TLP White, you know, maybe Krebs did. If he learned, I assume Krebs learned from a different source than the CISA alert. But if it's TLP White, there might be a reason that they're still holding it back. But at the same time, I think the amount of damage Krebs's post could do is relatively light, in my opinion, even though some other security folks seem to disagree.
Yep. I think that's a fair conclusion to make, too. But like, I could imagine a situation in the future where someone does jump the gun on this and it does cause malicious threat actors to carry out an attack before people are able to get their defenses up. So either way, in this case, like you said, it's basically like hospitals are targeted with ransomware every day, and I don't think jumping the gun saying that they're going to be targeted even more.
Oh, here's another thing you're targeted.
Exactly. Yeah. So kind of in line with this CISA alert coming out just a day or so before it, some researchers from the security organization Sonar Source released their analysis of four vulnerabilities in the OpenEMR software. So OpenEMR is a open source medical record software that encompasses everything from tracking medical records to having an entire patient portal where patients can create accounts and log in and schedule visits and view their medical records too. It's basically a whole suite of tools that's used by, according to their site at least, over 15,000 hospital systems. So they've got a pretty wide-ranging base. And a day or so before the CISA alert, these security researchers disclosed four security vulnerabilities that were really critical in the software that had actually been patched back in August, but that because of their criticality, they had held off on discussing them. So to go over a few of them real quick, basically it was a chain of vulnerabilities that could enable a unauthenticated attacker to execute whatever commands they wanted on the server where this OpenEMR software is installed. And typically with the software, you would expose the server to the internet, at least the web portal for it, to allow users to log in and view their accounts, which could enable anyone external to the organization to basically gain a foothold on the network.
But I will say one of the many all of these were web application vulnerabilities that you could chain together in certain ways. By the way, I guess one is technically a web API vulnerability, but I consider that kind of part of the web application. And for instance, there's a cross-site scripting vulnerability. But you might have heard us in the past talk about all cross-site scripting vulnerabilities can be relatively bad, but there's a difference between a persistent one versus a reflected one. And without going into a ton of detail, reflected ones, one, tend to require more user interaction from the victim, and two, tend to only affect the victim that of that web application that's being targeted. Whereas a persistent one doesn't need any user interaction. It tends to be something an attacker could put on a web application that when any user at all goes near the page where this is injected or added, they bad stuff happens. So of the cross-site scripting ones, this is the much worse one. And I really think it's the cross-site scripting one that leads to this chain of other bad stuff, because it was so easy for them to just add malicious code to the portal that all users would interact with. Lots of bad stuff happens after that.
I think it's actually worth the time to go a little into detail for a couple of these, because they're basically a case study of what happens when you don't follow the OWASP top 10 of secure web app coding practices. So like the first vulnerability in the chain is an API authentication bypass. So the API for this web app, this OpenEMR portal, requires authentication in order to access certain API functions. So you can imagine, in order to view your records or edit your name, you would need to authenticate to the API first in order to gain access to those functions. So the API authentication verification system, though, just checks whether the user, so the browser session or whatever, has a session with the API, and if they have an active user, or if they've started registering a new user. So the intended way to get into that situation would be if once you log in, you obviously have a user account in the portal, and now you also have a session, which means you are authenticated. Or if you're trying to create a new user, you might need to access some of the functions. So the registration function will create you a session and then allow you to hit other API functions. The vulnerability in this lies that when you go to begin the registration by hitting that registration endpoint on the API, it creates you a session, and then that session enables you to access all other API endpoints as well, which means that an attacker could begin registering as a new user on the portal, even if the actual web form of this wasn't displayed, the API is still there. So they could hit that, create a session, which then enables them to access all features of the API as a registered patient portal user, which includes a few things like changing the info of users. So the next step in this chain is where they can access an API endpoint that allows you to edit your last name. Like maybe you got married, maybe you just changed your last name. You can go in and through the portal, which then through this API lets you update your last name in the database. And the authors of OpenEMR did not escape the parameters for this update request. Basically, whatever you enter into the form is appended to a SQL query, which is then inserted into the database.
By the way, this is like a really, this is SQL injection. There's lots of different ways to accidentally expose it, but like the 101 way is hard coding a concatenated SQL query within your web code. That's like the SQL 101 do not do. You should be doing stored parameterized procedures that you're just calling, not actually having partial concatenated pieces of SQL queries that are in your web code. So to me, you should keep going with the chain, Mark, but essentially the TLDR, if you don't understand all the things Mark is saying, this is like, to me, and Mark, tell me if you agree, the worst in Barrett. This is really easy to exploit 101 stuff.
Yeah, it is super dangerous when it comes to like the actual security ramifications for it. It is technically possible to secure, but there are so many little things that if you miss one little bit, like you use the incorrect quotations for like single versus double in one spot, it allows someone to inject whatever they want into the command. So in this case, they weren't using the PHP HTML special characters function that's built in, which escapes, as you might guess, HTML special characters. Like,
But that's the crazy thing to me. And Mark, it's what I'm saying is these web developers did not do 101, because unescaping character, like you just said, unescaping characters is hard. SQL kind of has, if you look at RSnake's cross-site scripting thing, if one character you might use somewhere in HTML or script is being escaped, there's all kinds of sneaky ways to get around it. There's different characters you can use for the same thing. There's encodings. So unescaping is hard, which you'd think, okay, that gives developers an excuse that, oh, I missed one. But that doesn't, because there's pre-existing frameworks. You don't have to do anything as a developer, but use all these pre-existing frameworks that do this for you and do it the right way, because this is a problem that existed for a decade. You know what I mean? So the pre-made methods that are in these web frameworks that do the unescaping for you, just use them. I mean,
Exactly.
That can't be hard. It's like using printf versus print, you know? Use the function that actually does the bounds checking and the input sanitation. You don't have to write it. Yes, 10 years ago you had to write it, and that was the hard part. Nowadays, you don't have to write it. It's there.
You don't have to write it. So in the case of this one, it was allowing users to update their last name, which meant that an attacker that had then bypassed authentication on the API could update anyone's last name to be their last name plus a bunch of JavaScript, basically. And because it wasn't escaped, anywhere that that last name is displayed, such as your user page or when you log into the portal as your user, causes that hidden, basically, JavaScript to trigger and run in the context of the website. So using this, they could then force any user to, unbeknownst to them, execute another command within the OpenEMR application simply by logging in and navigating to a page where their last name is displayed, which meant that they could then go after administrators who have elevated privileges and are able to execute commands that potentially execute with system-level permissions on the server, including the backup command. So there's an API, or at least functionality within OpenEMR to back up all of its data. Probably a good function to have if you're having containing medical records. But again, this backup doesn't use parameterized input. It's basically a SQL command that is slapped together with by concatenating strings and then run through the PHP exec function, which is a system exec call, meaning it runs on the actual server itself. So in this case, it's trying to do a SQL query, but because you can escape the SQL query, you can run whatever system command you want at the permissions of the software, which is running typically at elevated permissions.
By the way, if you're interested in things like SQL injection, me and Mark have, I think I put the video up somewhere on my YouTube page, which you might be able to find from Sikplicity. We have really old 101 cross-site scripting and SQL injection videos that show this and tell you why it works. So for instance, when Mark says escaping the rest of the SQL query, like when you have a injection point on a website where you know there's a concatenated string, you tend to do something. You don't care about what the original web developer's query is, so you do something just to cut it off quickly, but then you use a semicolon, which in SQL language is another SQL command's about to follow because you quickly want to get to your SQL command. And we show a few ways how a login portal, you know, using a badly designed concatenated query for a username and password can be used, where even without the password, if there is a SQL injection in the login, you can escape the query that the web developer intended, but then add whatever you want to it. Or you could inject stuff into their query to make it always return a particular result. So anyways, if you know less about SQL injection, I do think that particular demo, regardless of your level of coding understanding, does kind of get you a better idea of how these particular vulnerabilities work.
Yeah, and typically with SQL injection, like you're trying to escape a quotation, like a single or a double quote, and there's built-in functions to almost every framework, PHP included, that are designed to escape quotations that are entered into a command. And interestingly, so this, the OpenEMR portal, with this one command, they were actually using the MSQLI real escape string function. So they were escaping quotations, which is good. Like, so the security researchers even noted that, you know, if they tried to use single quotes or double quotes, that function would escape them with a backslash so that they couldn't inject that way.
That's good.
Yeah. But because the authors of the software created this whole string, this command string, using double quotes on the outside instead of single quotes, backticks were not escaped. So the yes, the real escape string function doesn't escape backticks, and backticks are another way to escape out of strings and execute whatever you want. So in this case, they were then able to build a command that could then execute commands within the exec function. So their example, they just created a file on the file system of the server. But if you were a attacker, you could do whatever you wanted. You could launch a shell and go download a script and then execute it. And that script then give you command and control on the server. And then that you could use that to then hit other servers, basically do whatever you wanted. So all because they used double quotes instead of single quotes on the outside of the command and then single quotes on the inside.
That's why you got to use someone else's escaping functions.
Yeah.
By the way, I said it before, but I really love giving kudos and shout outs to the old folks in security. So, you know, RSnake, you might hear me mention RSnake's XSS cheat sheet a lot. Just Google that. I mean, and that's the beauty. What Mark was just talking about is there's like 100 ways to skin a cat in SQL queries. There's 100 different ways where certain characters can do similar things. So if you're really interested, you know, in all the different ways, if XYZ characters are being escaped and monitored properly, RSnake's XSS cheat sheet shows you all kinds of alternate ways to try to still get this to work using different characters and different encodings. So really shout out to this like decades old cheat sheet from RSnake, because it's still heavily used by bad guys today. And for good guys, this should be like a roadmap to what you need to look for to avoid this kind of stuff. What additional things you need to escape or implement properly in your web application.
And you mentioned your YouTube videos are pretty old. Like, these are old and solved issues.
These are classic.
Like,
yes,
they are. This is, I think, number like 1 and 2, basically, on the OWASP top 10.
Well, that's the thing I want to argue with, because there's this, I've heard a tech community, so they are old and solved from a theoretical point of view. We know what to do to avoid this. The industry knows what to do as long as you're not lazy enough not to implement it. But the one thing that I want to fight back at, and this is a perfect example of how powerful web application vulnerabilities are. I've heard some in the security community, and even some old school IT guys that I won't throw out names, but ones that you and me have known in the past personally, that says, oh, cross-site scripting, that's like a 2090s flaw. No one has those problems anymore. It's not a big deal.
2090s. Or they imply that... Oh, 2000 or 90s. I said, okay.
I wanted to say 1990s, because actually the person I'm referring to said 90s, but the truth is cross-site scripting wasn't a deal. It wasn't until the 2000s you had a lot of dynamic web apps. But it was a 2000s issue. His point was cross-site scripting's not a big deal, it's old. And he also would argue things like the impact of it's small, because he thinks about the reflected ones where you just get one user's cookies. That's not true at all. These are powerful, especially when you have multiple web app vulnerabilities like we're talking about here that can be chained. XSS include with command injection gives you a ton of ability on to you know, pretty much take over a website. So my point, I just wanted to point out, you're absolutely right that these are not new problems. They're old, they're well researched, and the mitigations are all there, and which is I think what you were implying by solved. But I want to point out specifically from the people out there with set websites, they are not solved. They're still one of the most web application vulnerabilities are all over the place still. So what I'm getting at is these should be solved, but a lot of web applications are not doing the right thing.
Right. Basically, every web framework has functions, easy to use functions in place to like prevent and mitigate a lot of these issues. And it's just a matter of, as a web developer,
and implementation guides, yes, for how to do things like avoiding even using concatenated SQL queries and do something else, or XYZ.
Yeah.
Yep.
And like through my own like journeys through web development, most documentation for most like databases and web frameworks have very explicit call outs saying, here's how you do this. By the way, here's how you absolutely do not do this. Do not concatenate strings like this. Use this method instead. So it's like, it's a matter of not just Googling your way to a Stack Exchange article, but actually like understanding web app development, reading documentation, following the OWASP top 10, and making sure that you're like patching against them, and then also testing against these types of attacks too.
If we're throwing fault too, I think part of it might be in how we teach new developers development. Like, this is something that was definitely true of when I went to college. But I'm hearing, while we are starting to see more cybersecurity courses in colleges, for the people out there that teach new web development, secure coding should be part of the curriculum. It's not just about making sure they know how to code, making sure they know how to solve problems with code, making sure they understand syntax and logic and all that, but making sure to what not to do. So as you're kind of pointing out, the industry has solved this and has things. And if you as a coder go look through the documentation, you'll find a lot on this, but maybe the problem is you have to go look. And I think that might be a failure in education. And this is a part of the coding education that should be mandatory. It shouldn't just be about the coding itself, but it should be about the secure coding practices as well. And I think that's what is still even lacking in this day and age in a lot of educational institutes. Although I think it's getting better from back when I was in college.
And that would solve at least one problem, but there is also still the issue of just self-taught developers as well that just they didn't have a formal education, which is, there's nothing wrong with that, but it also means that you might miss out on a lot of these like secure coding practices.
Yeah. The good news there, like you say, is if you are self-taught, you're used to going and finding all this yourself. So you could have the opportunity to, there is a ton of detail about this everywhere, but like you say, you don't know what you don't know. So if they're only looking for the coding part of it and don't know to look for the secure coding part of it, it could be easy to miss for them.
But either way, so like long story short, there were four very critical vulnerabilities. They were patched in August in this software. And I did like do some Googling around to a few of the six hospitals that were explicitly called out in most of the news organizations. And the few I spot checked were not using OpenEMR. They were using other competing like paid software stacks for this. But for any of the hundreds of other hospitals that were targeted, this could have been one potential avenue of attack because, like, as we know, even though the patches were out in August, especially in the healthcare industry, it can take a long time for some of these things to get patched, especially, like, largely because these are critical systems. Like, you need access to healthcare records, and there is a hesitation to do anything that modifies these systems. Like, installing a patch isn't without risk, and so there is the chance it could go sideways, which also is why you need to test patches before you deploy them, but still do them quickly. Don't sit around for 2 months.
By the way, kudos to the, was it Sonar Source that found this? In that, like you say, a lot of times, like we get vulnerability reports from the industry, and Mark and I are the team that helps respond to those. Usually we let our researchers, as soon as we have a patch, they can detail their research. But I believe these researchers, because of what you just said about healthcare maybe being slow to patch and these being so critical, that they really, even when OpenEMR had the patches back in August, as you say, it's taken them until now to release it, because it sounds like they were very responsible in giving the potential victims plenty of time to take care of it. So just extra kudos for that. That is, you know, not only was it responsible, even if they released after the patch, the amount of time they gave is really beyond the call, maybe not beyond the call of duty, but more than a lot of people do. So really appreciated, I would think, by all the people out there that are customers of healthcare services.
Yeah, exactly. So big thumbs up to them. If you are a hospital or a healthcare provider and you are using OpenEMR, hopefully you have installed that patch by now, because it's been a couple of months. Oh, so moving on, at the time where this podcast airs, it'll be, what, November 2nd, so the day before Election Day. I imagine for quite a few of our U.S.-based listeners and potentially people across the world, you're probably sitting there in nervous anticipation.
Hurry up!
Yeah.
Hurry up! I want it to be over!
Exactly. But the day before elections, we actually have a couple of news updates on election hacking-related topics. So the first up, on October 23rd, the Republican Party of Wisconsin identified that they had lost $2.3 million due to a phish. So the threat actor in this case doctored invoices that spoofed regular vendors that the party worked with and tricked their accountants into routing payments into the attackers' accounts instead of the regular vendors' accounts. And this style of attack is actually pretty common. So back in February, the FBI released a report that noted that businesses lost $1.7 billion in 2019 due to what they call business email compromise, so phishing attacks like this. And even just last week, the security firm abnormal security released their quarterly business email.
That sounds like one of those fancy Silicon Valley names like Google and the nonsensical words.
Yes.
We should start a company called blah blah blah.
Yeah, I'm going to go get the domain name right now. But they just a couple weeks ago or last week released their business email compromise report where they noted there was a 15% increase in business email compromise quarter over quarter and a 155% increase in the invoice and payment fraud department specifically. They also noted one other takeaway. The largest increase was in the energy and infrastructure industry. They're being targeted the most. But basically, these style of attacks are already prolific, $1.7 billion in 1 year. And also on the rise, largely because like they work. Like it's really easy to social engineer a untrained individual to.
It, by the way, it shouldn't be because, as you mentioned, this is 5 years old. We've all heard the stories of the accountant that got an email from the CFO with an invoice to pay. I would hope that most accountants understand that if they're paying big sums from a weird email invoice, they should probably validate by now. So very interesting. It's interesting that it's going up, but I'm so surprised because, for instance, our accounting team gets things like this all the time. Our past CFO used to send them to me all the time. It's just surprising to me that there's an accountant that's not aware of this particular threat vector.
Yeah, and you're right. Like, there's a pretty easy mitigation for it, and it's basically just pick up the phone anytime that one of these, like, account change notifications comes through and call the vendor directly and say, hey, just want to make sure that this came from you. Cool. All right, done.
Especially if it's, like, a $2.3 million, in, you know, especially for the big invoices in particular.
Exactly. On the technical standpoint, there's also ways that you could potentially help protect your organization and the people you work with. Like, we've talked about SPF, DKIM, and DMARC a few times as email anti-spoofing technologies that can help mitigate the chance of someone else spoofing your email domain. Obviously, that is only one tiny piece of defense in the case of these, but it is at least something you can do.
But it does mean that if the accountant getting this from their quote-unquote CFO, you know, if you do not do DMARC, you might actually see your CFO's real address. The actual very real email, and that might be why you're falling for it. If you have DMARC, you might see something that looks like your CEO's name, but there's going to be something about the domain that's tricky that you will have the opportunity to recognize visually that is not really your the email address of your CFO or whoever you're getting this from. So just to make it clear, DMARC doesn't block their ability to try to phish you, but it means the sender email address is not going to be able to be masqueraded very well. So looking at sender address would be a good way to identify if it's fake or not.
Yeah. And basically security is all about making it a little bit harder for attackers to make it a little less likely for them to succeed in their attack. And so this is just one small thing you can do to make it a little more difficult for them and give your accountants or just other users and employees a chance to catch that fish. Obviously, it still has to be paired with phishing training, teaching them how to spot these fishes. But these days, that is like 100% commoditized, and there are so many different people you can go with in order to get good phishing awareness training for your users. Like you said, like this is a five-year-old problem. It's a really old problem that just basic security practices.
By the way, that was a guesstimate, but we've been seeing these invoice attacks for quite a long time. I guesstimate about 5 years. They've been pretty regular.
Yeah. And I mean, I know we're poo-pooing.
By the way, this one is less about election hacking and more about just a party getting a normal cybercrime hack, though.
Yep, correct.
What's the other news?
So the next one, though, was police arrested last week a 20-year-old after identifying that they had changed the address of Florida Governor Ron DeSantis in the state's voting registration database, which prevented him from voting early last Monday. Basically, he went into the polling station and they noted that his address was no longer valid. The individual said he was able to issue the change with publicly available information on the governor, including his name and date of birth. And like I looked into this in Washington State, where we're based out of, and it's basically the same there. Like in Washington State, you can cancel someone's voter registration by just knowing their name and date of birth. You can also print a ballot. So mark your ballot online, print it out, and mail it in from there, which invalidates the ballot that they mail to you. And all you need for that is a name and a date of birth. Like, there's not a whole lot of information protecting this.
Yeah, and by the way, things like date of birth, one, everyone gives it away on Facebook if they make anything public. And two, there's been so many breaches that date of birth, you know, there's some PII is important, but there's some PII I've given up on as far as email addresses, addresses, and date of birth, simply because there's been so many leaks in the U.S. Just the, what was the social security number credit
the OPM?
Check agency?
Oh, Equifax.
Equifax. Just the Equifax breach alone has put most adults' date of birth in public domain. So crazy easy. I would like to give us an unfortunate negative pat on the back, and I believe that one of our election-related predictions, if you noticed when we talked about what we predict for this this election year for hacking, we keep on mentioning while voting machines and very direct attacks on the vote might be possible, we think they're very unlikely, but we did think that, you know, bad guys stole registration databases back in 2016, but they didn't act on them other than maybe using them as targeted disinformation materials. But we said that one of the things that we could be targeted this year was actually executing on this voter registration with the specific use case of if you can deregister someone, you might be able to cancel their vote. So while it's only one case, this does kind of prove some of our prediction there.
Yeah. And while, like, let's say in the case of Washington State, in order to cancel someone's registration, you have to mail in a form. And if suddenly every county received hundreds of thousands of forms to cancel everyone's registration, that would set off alarm bells. But like with the way the electoral system in this country works, you don't have to cancel everyone's registration in the country. Like, you pick the counties that are in really contested that could swing an entire state one direction or another, and you pick off enough voters from one potential party or another, and you could impact the election in that case. Like, I think in the 2016 election, it was Michigan or Wisconsin, one of those. Like, it basically came down to a couple hundred votes in, like, two or three counties that decided the entire state's electoral college votes. So if you could go in and, using the dumps of voter registration data that we've had over the past few years, or even just the freely available ones, and just deregister a couple hundred voters, you could potentially affect the impact. Like, this is a real possible scenario. Whether someone's going to maliciously exploit it or not is still up for debate, because if you got caught, you would basically...
This kind of targeted one seems a little more like political trolling from some single hacker to me. But on the flip side, the news of it is probably giving real threat actors, state-sponsored threat actors, some ideas.
Exactly. Either way, like in the case of this, they were able to fix DeSantis' voter registration. I imagine he got a little fast-tracked because he is the governor of the state. And it might be a little more difficult for a random rank-and-file citizen. But still another, you know, election-related story that I hope we can just stop talking about starting next week.
I notice it's not exactly election related, but I'm surprised you talking about the presidential race. There's one story that I think kind of came out in the weekend, last weekend, that I'm surprised you haven't mentioned, Mark.
That Donald Trump's campaign website got hacked.
Yeah, that was an interesting defacement.
Yeah, someone defaced it and demanded a bunch of Bitcoin in order to return access. In their ransom note, they also noted that they had gotten private information on Trump and his family from it as well, which I imagine is probably inaccurate. It does seem more like just a defacement, but like that one's basically like just egg in the face. Like, it's not stealing a bunch of money.
Yeah, that one seems more like old school script kiddie defacement for the lols to me. I don't really think they necessarily are going to drop information, but it was definitely badly timed.
Yes,
as you so aptly put, maybe Trump's campaign should go to Rudy Giuliani's security company to get protection.
The one where as soon as people found out that he had a security company 4 or 5 years ago, they port scanned his website and found every single database and API and everything port open under the sun. That sounds great.
That's good security nowadays, Mark. No one needs zero trust. We need all open.
100% trust. No attestation.
Yes.
I like it.
100% trust.
We should go deface his website and make that the motto.
Cool. Well, great stories this week, Mark.
Yep. And I think, like you, are hoping to no longer have to talk about election security, at least for the next 2 or 4 years.
I have a feeling the election will carry on for a little while after the date, but it will be nice not to talk about election security for a bit.
Exactly. Hey, everyone. Thanks again for listening. As always, if you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. If you have any questions on today's topics or suggestions for future episode topics, you can reach out to us on Twitter. I'm at @XORRO_. Corey is at @SecAdept. And the both of us are at #The443Podcast. Thanks again for listening, and you will hear from us next week. And please remember to go vote.